Radio Podcast, and happy St. Patrick's Day. We're recording this on St. Patrick's Day for all you Irish folk out there.
Yeah, everyone's Irish. Yeah, everyone's Irish today.
Everyone's right? Irish today, even though the episode comes Saints. Out on Monday. But today is St. Patrick's Day.
That's yes, right.
Boondock Saints is one of the great Irish films out there.
The Irish film to watch.
It is, there's a few Irish films out there, like that one, Snatch. You know, it's funny.
Snatch is good.
I was realizing, the other day, we've never done any of Guy Ritchie's. I don't know if we've even done a Guy Ritchie film on the podcast. We've got some holes coming up, in May, and some stuff to fill in. And don't be surprised when I send you the list if I drop Snatch on that list somewhere, because that's a
good one, man.
I like Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels, but Snatch is definitely the better of the two films. So that might get dropped in there. I was like, man, it's such a cool film too.
Brad
Guy
Pitt.
Ritchie, man, he made some really good crime films early in his career, and and recently The Gentleman was good. So maybe he's getting back to that style. I like Guy Ritchie with that style of film. But that was a film. But yes, everyone is Irish today officially. I did not wear green though. I'm wearing all black. I think even my underwear is black. Not that the listeners need to know that.
Damn. Yeah, no green for me today either. I didn't go out, so I was like,
I went and visited our friends at Misfit Toys, the wonderful Daniel and his crew, and sold him some toys and bought him some stuff. And I have to always throw props to him. Such a man. If you live in Houston or you're visiting Houston, there's no other toy shop you want to go visit than Misfit
for
toys.
Sure, man.
The best toy shop in town. And I no disrespect at all to the other great toy shops, but I just have a good relationship with Daniel and just a good crew over there. Him and David and the other guys that run their stores are just excellent people, man. And they truly, yes, they're in it for a business. They want to make money, but they're also in it to make their customers happy, man. Daniel will make sure you're walking out of his store satisfied and happy with what your purchase and what you bought. And that's the way it is. And we've done some live podcasts from there and talking to him today about some things. And we hopefully the future is set up where we can do another live show for Misfit Toys, possibly as early as this summer.
Yeah, we definitely miss doing that.
It was always fun to do. Yeah, it's fun. And COVID kind of happened and remote podcasting kind of went away, but now that the world has seemed to settle down from that, we can get back doing fun stuff like that. And hopefully soon, man, but definitely a huge shout out to the guys at Misfit Toys and Daniel and his crew. And another shout out I want to give, and we're going to stay local for a minute this week. I've been off this week, and I went to see the Houston Toy Museum here in town that opened up last fall.
Oh, yeah.
And they were promoting it at Comic Palooza last year. And I met the guy, I don't know his name, man. I apologize on that. But it's over there in the Heights also, and they were running a deal this week where the kids got in for their age. So it saved me a little money to take them this week, and it's neat, man. You walk in, and it's a gift shop, and it looks like a really small building, but then you go to the museum in the back, and it opens up to about 4,000 square feet of just fucking toys, man, from the 1940s and 50s, erector sets and dolls and some really creepy dolls, as my kid pointed out. I'm like, yeah, those early dolls were kind of creepy. Two G.I. Joes and Star Wars and some anime stuff, Pokemon, He-Man. The guy had all kinds of cool stuff to check out, and I hope it continues to grow. I felt like he had a lot of room in there for more stuff. I think they can fill that building with a lot more cool stuff and continue to put a lot of cool toys in the building. But props to them for a really cool museum, a really cool idea. In a big city like this, can use something like that, especially as huge as the market is now, and people our age, man, buying up their old toys that they had when they were kids and collecting them. And the toy market shows no signs of slowing down as people want that vintage retro stuff. And really cool, man, to have a Houston Toy Museum here in H-Town. So props off to those guys. Worth a visit, man. I think it's cool. It's neat stuff. So I had a good week doing that, and got some other things accomplished this week when I was off. And strangely, I didn't watch a whole lot extra other than the two current most popular shows on TV. But, man, before I go on, how was your week, man? Man, you been all right hanging out there, Matt?
Yeah. I didn't do a whole lot of cool stuff, but I did. Yeah. Yeah. You know,
I mean, I'm not really cool either. I mean, I'm just, you know, we're dads now.
But
we're not
we got cool moments. I think we have some cool moments.
And then, we tell our kids about our cool moments. They look at us like, nah, dad, no.
You know?
So they're not impressed.
Not impressed, man. But I did, you know, we had talked about what movies we were interested in last year and seeing, and one of mine was Cocaine Bear. So I went ahead and did the theater at home thing, and I bought it. I was like, you know what? I'm just going to get it. Horror, you know, comedy.
I was thinking about that today, man. You know,
yeah,
these movies are coming out. It feels, that's another thing. I feel like right now, since COVID, we go through these stale moments where there's not a whole lot out, you know, and the theaters are starting to get back, you know, John Wick's coming out and Dungeons and Dragons and Guardians of the Galaxy 3, but there's still like a lot of lulls in entertainment right now. I feel like I'm clicking through my streaming services and there's nothing that I want to watch. But then I started thinking that like these movies like Megan are coming out and Cocaine Bear, and they're putting them out on Fandango at home or wherever the fuck you want to call it, theater at home. And there's these suckers, one that's sitting right across from me through the screen, that keep buying these movies for $20. And then they're going to realize later on, why did I buy this? It's not that great. It's like I watched it once and I spent $20. And because you need to be patient, Matt. All this shit's going to streaming within 45 days.
Yeah.
You know, but Matt, yeah. But there's Matt. Keeps this, they just sucker him right in like, oh, we're going to get this guy by the balls and make him spend $20 on a movie. You know,
it's worth it. I think for like the kids movies, like I did it for superhero pets, League of Superhero Pets, whatever.
Again, still showed up in HBO Max a couple weeks later.
It did. But like, if you're looking to, you're like, okay, well, the kids want to go see this movie. They want me to take them, but I'm going to spend like $80 on drinks.
Yeah. The pandemic, sure.
Yeah. But like, you know, if you can get away with, you know, that stuff. Yeah. But like for Cocaine Bear, I got taken. You know, Megan, I got taken.
I've done it twice. And they were both early on. It was Scoob, which was a kid's movie. And then the one movie even I regret was Bill and Ted's Face of Music. I wanted to see it, and then I'm like, man, why did I do this? I should have waited. But I'm not suckered in like you are.
Yeah. I definitely take the bait more often than I don't. That's for sure. And this one, I think I could have waited until it came out. It was, you know, of course, it's Ray Liotta's last film that he did. He plays a part. As this movie is based off of a real story from 1985, where a bunch of cocaine was dumped in a Chattahoochee forest and a bear consumed about 75 pounds of it.
But the real story was the bear died. Ran about 100 feet and died.
Yeah, ran like really, really hard for like 100 feet and then just died because nothing on this earth except maybe a friggin', you know, elephant, maybe, can consume 75 pounds of cocaine and still live. So instead of it being, you know, instead of him dying, the bear becomes addicted, as you see in the trailers. And it's kind of like it's almost like they adapt that cocaine usage as kind of like sleeping around in a horror movie. You don't want it touching you. You don't want to interact with that because anyone that touches the cocaine or is involved in the cocaine, it seems like they're subject for this killer's romp, the killer being, of course, the Cocaine Bear. And it's entertaining. It's kind of like Dale Tucker, versus evil kind of movie. It's kind of like that. So if you like those kind of movies, the Shaun of the Dead type stuff, then you'll definitely like it. It's entertaining enough, but I think it's one of those movies you can definitely wait for it to come out to watch to get it under your belt. If you want to spend the $20 to $25, then, you know, heck, you know, you want to see a bear do cocaine?
I'm not even suckering to rent movies. Like, I really want to see Spielberg's The Fablemans, but even that, I'm like, I want to spend $6. I'm the only one in the house is going to watch it because I know it's probably going to hit some sort of streaming service soonish.
Yeah. You
know? And I want to see that. Like, now I did watch, I did renew my Peacock just because Wyatt really wanted to see Puss in Boots, The Last Wish.
Oh,
and
I sat
down and watched it with them, and it was actually pretty good. I sat and watched it with them. It was very entertaining. I was like,
I liked it.
I caught myself. I'm like, I'm not going to watch this. And the next thing I know, I'm sitting down and I'm watching it with them. Yeah. It was one of those kind of kid movies. And it was really entertaining. A lot of really funny jokes in it that are dropped very quickly that the kids may not notice. But I appreciate that when they do that for the adults. They drop a lot of jokes and they're like, oh, that was funny. And the kids don't catch it, but the adults do. They're not necessarily bad jokes or anything. They're just witty.
Yeah. They'll go over your head if you don't know what they're talking about.
And there's quite a few of those in Puss in Boots. And it was fun, man. It was an enjoyable movie. And I like the way it ended, as there's been a lot of rumors that DreamWorks is working on another Shrek film. And they kind of tease that at the end of Puss in Boots, that there might be another Shrek film coming. So, you know, even Mike Myers has thrown shade that way. He says, I can't say anything without saying anything in interviews he's done. So it appears that it's true that they are possibly doing another Shrek. How many Shreks were there? Four? So this will be the fifth one?
I thought it was four. Yeah. Shrek, Shrek 2, Shrek 3.
Yeah, it was like, because was the fourth one like a fancy name, like Shrek Forever After? Yeah, it was.
Yeah.
One of those
Shrek
fancy.
The third, and then Shrek Forever After.
Yeah. Those fancy wordplay names they do, how clever they think they are. but yeah, it was fun. It was an entertaining movie. You know, I don't know how entertaining it was compared to Cocaine Bear, but both entertaining in their own rights. So,
Oh, yeah.
But other than that, man, I let's start with the Mandalorian, because
now we got two episodes we can talk about.
You didn't watch last week, but now you're caught up. The new episode. I kind of have to admit, I felt a little bit like my kids said, like, is Mando going to be in this episode? I'm like, yeah, I don't know. He was at the beginning, and now they did the Andor thing with a slow moving, kind of boring subplot with the scientists way back from the season one. And I mean, as a storytelling element, I'm sure it's leading up to something. But it was a little boring. I'm just not going to lie. I was like, come on. This is not what I watched Mandalorian. That was fine in Andor. It worked in Andor. But that's not what I'm watching Mandalorian for. You know, and it was just kind of a snooze fest of an episode other than Mando getting
four Imperials and an AA type meeting.
Yeah. It was okay. It's arguably.
I'm Bob and I was a stormtrooper.
Yeah. It was arguably, out of the 18 episodes we've had so far, arguably the most boring, possible worst episode they've done. I mean, that's just how I feel about it.
I've seen videos that people have posted online that said how to watch the newest episode of The Mandalorian, and it shows them stopping after the TIE Interceptor scene and then fast-forwarding it all the way until they get redeemed.
Oh, yeah. The beginning was great. I mean, the TIEs after him, all that, when Bo-Katan and him escaping, that was awesome. That's pure Star Wars. It was wonderful. And then it just completely slowed down. And then we got to the end, and we got a little more at the end with Mando. And, I don't know if they're teasing a return of Moff Gideon. We know Moff's not done, because even Giancarlo in interviews has said, oh, I'm sure I'll be back, you know. But I have to wonder that there's someone even above him, a big baddie involved in this. You know, there's a lot of word that, you know, we know they're making Ahsoka and Ezra is going to be introduced, and Sabine, and what, General Thrawn's possibly out there still.
That's what I thought.
I'm thinking maybe he's behind all this at the end. You know, it's what does
I see this to. Major fleet, and it's like Thrawn's got to be the guy. That would be cool, because that's who most of those books were about. That George Lucas had a approved story writing for in between, around years Shadows ago. Of the Empire and stuff like that. Yeah.
So, you know, but, you know, we can forgive the Mandalorian for his transgressions, just as he was forgiven as he bathed in the waters of Mandalore and is now part of the clan again. And so is Bo-Katan. She's sort of like, oh, I guess. Thanks. I'm like, you can almost see her acting through her helmet, like, oh, I really didn't want to be a part of your clan, but I guess I am.
Yeah. Like, have you removed your helmet? No, I guess not, but it's kind of stuffy in here. I was thinking about it. Well, if you don't remove it, you can be one of us.
Oh, and then Grant had this article about it might be the last we'll see Pedro Pascal as the Mandalorian because he doesn't need to take his mask off. Okay, first off, it's no secret that Pedro, for the last couple of seasons, has mostly done voice work and very little work in the suit. That's no secret anyway. We all know this because he's busy doing movies and Last of Us and things like that. But I'm sure at some point we'll see his face again. You know, I mean, he's, you know, it's just inevitable, you know. Mm-hmm. So I thought it was interesting that this website would write this entire article about whether we'll see his face. Like, what does it fucking matter? You know, it's like, I mean, who cares? It's like,
yeah, dude, just enjoy the moment. You know?
Exactly.
Like Qui-Gon said, you know, in a way, you know, it's like whenever in episode one and Obi-Wan is like, you know, focused on the future and Qui-Gon says not at the expense of the present. Don't let the present get away because you're looking at the future. Just look at what's happening right now. That's all that matters,
baby. And then the episode before that you got caught up on, it was fun, but very dark. I had trouble seeing a lot of the episode, and a lot of critics even said that. They said they pulled a Game of Thrones. I guess there was a Game of Thrones episode one time that was so dark people had trouble seeing what was going on. I did feel like that watching that episode of Mandalorian where they go under the water and all that, and it's like, what was going on? You know, and my brightness has turned up pretty bright on my TV because I want my 4K to look good. And I had trouble seeing what was going on, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It's like, but it was still a good episode. You know, that one was. And then we got
that one was good.
Andorish episode.
Andorish.
It was okay. But hopefully, you know, the Mandalorian redeems itself this coming week and brings back some action and no more scientists moping around Coruscant. It was cool to see Coruscant return into the Star Wars universe.
Yeah, that was fun.
And, you know, and that's about it on that episode. but it's okay. You know, we've been spoiled with how good Mandalorian has been so far. So I guess one episode that kind of like, you know, I did feel a little bad for the scientist guy because I think he really was trying to do better for himself, and then he gets really screwed. You know,
yeah, some freaking tattletale.
Yeah,
like, but she looks like if Boba Fett had a sister.
Yeah,
you know, and she, doesn't she kind of look like that?
She also looks like she would kick a lot of dudes' asses.
Yeah,
she's kind of scary looking.
Yeah,
no, I forgot. Was she a Moth? She was like Moth's right hand woman or something.
I think so.
Moff Gideon. Yeah. So I remember her, but I don't remember what she did. Now all of a sudden she's got like these speaking parts and she's important. It's like, oh, yeah, okay. But it's cool. But we also got the season finale this week of The Last of Us. Other than a couple of minor changes from the game, it pretty much played out how things do in the game. As Joel and Ellie finally reach their destination to the Fireflies, and Joel turns Ellie over to them to see what they can do with her as far as finding a cure, and come to find out that they can't get the cure unless they basically kill Ellie because they have to go into her brain. Joel's not having that. He's going this far and taking her on, and he's just like, you know, he's willing to sacrifice the good of the planet to save this little girl that he cares about now. And we get to see more brutal Joel as he goes through the hospital, just gunning people down left and right. Yeah. And he rescues Ellie, and he it's basically an action packed episode where he rescues Ellie and he kills Marlene at the end too. And he escapes with her. And just like in the game, I feel like watching, I don't think it's so much that he lies to Ellie. Well, he does lie to her, but to me, watching it from a parent's perspective, and they say this even in the making of, I even felt that when I played the game, sometimes you lie to your kids to protect them. And I feel that's more what Joel's doing. He tells Ellie, he doesn't tell Ellie the complete truth because he's not sure she's ready for it yet. As he basically tells her that, no, there is no cure. He doesn't tell her that, you know, if she had her choice to be killed to save the world, would she have? He doesn't give her that choice. He kind of takes it from her, but in some ways it feels like the right thing to do. And that is addressed eventually in part two when it comes out. And But there's some great moments right from the game. You know, the giraffe moment, which they use a real giraffe, that's in the game. That was cool. I think the only difference that there is a scene in the game, if I remember right, when he first, Joel and Ellie first get near the hospital, they have to fight a bloater. So again, the show took some liberties with that, took a little less action out, than they had in the actual game. But I think the show overall through its 9 episodes did its job of telling the story and really well, it done really well overall. I mean, the show was excellent. Its ratings kept going up and up every week. People started getting behind the show and looking forward to season 2. But overall, I thought it was a wonderful adaptation of the game and really well done. And from an outside perspective, someone who hasn't played the game, I mean, what are kind of your final thoughts of the finale and the way the season played out?
Dude, he's fucking brutal. Whenever you mess with someone he cares about, mm-hmm. he's like, where's the operating room? I don't have time for this. You had 2 seconds. That's 1 second long.
And there's some guilt. And he mentions it. There's some guilt to him with what happened to Sarah. They didn't react quickly enough, and he's not going to have that again. He's like, No, I'm not going to make that mistake again.
Yep. So he ain't got time for no bullshit. Mm-mm. But yeah. And then, you know, I saw that clip of the game. Cause I've been trying to, you know, try and see it from someone who's played the game's point of view. I did see that. I think I sent you that, and you probably caught on to it before I did, that the voice actor, from that girl, the daughter of the surgeon in part 2, is one of the nurses.
Abby. Yeah.
Yeah. Abby.
Yeah.
So I wonder if that's some foreshadowing, you know,
the only thing I'm trying to remember is in the game, I think you kill all the nurses too. You take out that whole room. If I remember right. I could be wrong on that, but for some reason I thought I went in there brutally and I just took them all out in the game. You know,
I know the doctor gets killed.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, you killed the doctor. Like, I remember sure. taking out the other ones too, but maybe not. You know, it's hard to remember. Hmm. But yeah, overall, man, it's such a good adaption. Just a good well done television show. Because even if you never played the game, man, you could watch this and enjoy the heck out of the show.
Oh yeah. And I think it's good for both people that don't know and people that do. Whereas, like, you know, I feel like Resident Evil. And I keep bringing it up. Resident Evil, it's only, I think, only appealing to people that never played the video game. Because it's like they get it so wrong on trying to adapt some of the video game. And it's like over here, it's like they pretty much adapt most of it. I mean, there's a lot of times it's shot for shot in multiple sequences.
Right.
It changed some stuff, of course, but it's, you know, pretty much, you know, appeasing both types of viewers, you know, whether you're familiar or unfamiliar.
Hmm.
So that's really cool.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, there's not a whole lot I would change about it. You know, maybe a couple extra infected scenes, you know, I could have maybe used a little more action. But other than that, I mean, it's easy and cliche to say, oh, I would change the Bill episode cause it wasn't necessary, but that I don't want to sound like a, you know, arrogant or anything like that, because it has nothing to do with me to the story. I'm fine with the story they told with Bill. It was a well done love story, but I do feel like, I don't know how much it really added to the overall arc. You know, it was okay. So maybe if I would have maybe done that a little differently, but yeah. It's fine. It just felt like an episode that could have been used for some other things that happened in the game. But you know, it is what it is. And I just mean that from a storytelling standpoint. It has nothing to do with the story that was told. I just felt like it was the one episode that didn't add a whole lot to the overall arc. Because if there had been a way that it came back to the importance of that story, I think maybe. But it really didn't, at least not in the first season. So it feels like it feels now more like a filler episode, even though it was a well-told story. But you know,
that's kind of what I gather, because it's like, you know, Joel shows up with Ellie and then it's like, oh yeah, look, he's got a battery in the fridge,
right,
for the Chevy.
Well, and then they lose the car and the stuff they load into it within the first 10 minutes of the next episode.
Yeah.
So it all felt like, okay, well, what's the point in all that? You know?
Could have told Henry's story a little bit better. You know, had you maybe cut some stuff from that episode.
Yeah. The Henry episode is still probably the best episode of the show. I mean, they did such a good job in a short time developing Henry and his brother and just the emotional impact at the end of the episode. I mean, I sat there for a few minutes afterwards, just collecting my thoughts, you know, like, wow, you know, and I had played the game, so I knew it was coming, and it still hit me hard watching it. I was just like, wow, that was intense, you know, and this is a well-told story. So
it has me wonder if we're going to get that scene where Ellie, you know, asks Joel to tell her the truth, and he does. And she says, you know, I'll go with you, you know, to town, but we're done after that.
Right.
You know, I wonder if we get that.
Yeah. We'll see. They've already said that part two will be told over a couple of seasons. Which, yes, part two is a more in-depth game. I also can't help but think that there's some, like, hey, we're making really good ratings. Let's spread this thing out some.
Yeah. You know,
let's not be two seasons and done. So we'll see. I'm not going to say anything about what happens in the game. I know a lot of people know what happens, but my thoughts are where they'll end season two. I wouldn't be surprised if they end season two with that scene and leave people waiting, like, to see, oh my God, what happens? Cause that would be the cliffhanger of all cliffhangers.
This is a show that's not, you know, I know a lot of stuff is derived from the game. They're not afraid to use it. It's right. Like, I didn't think that Joel was going to lose his daughter in the first episode.
Yeah.
And, you know, that showed me that they weren't afraid to, you know, do something shocking to the viewer, like do something that you wouldn't expect. So I feel like in the first episode,
they killed Tessa in the second episode.
It's like, so I think next season, that first episode, you don't know what you're going to get. It can be something way out of left field. You know, that the viewer isn't expecting, and same thing for the finale. So I like that. I like that, you know, it's going to keep you on your toes, keep you wondering.
Yeah. So we'll see where it goes. HBO Max has all 9 episodes, the first season of The Last of Us. If you've been hearing us talk about it each week, go get caught up.
Yeah. Now you can binge it all at once.
Let's do a little news before we get to today's featured film. James Gunn has decided he's going to direct Superman Legacy. He announced it this week, which not really surprised by this, to be honest. He kind of hinted at it that he was writing and he might direct it. Yeah, I'm still struggling, Matt, to get excited about James Gunn's DC Studios. The more and more I really think about James Gunn, is like someone made a good point, man. Man of Steel made almost $700 million worldwide. People remember the movie. There's action scenes they like in it. Most people don't remember Suicide Squad, his movie. They're like, I remember there was like a starfish in it, but it just wasn't memorable. And people can blame the pandemic and all that it came out. But, you know, I'm just really wondering, man. I just don't know, dude. I think The Rock
had a good point. You know, he's like, it's like you have a team that wins. And that sells tickets and performs well, people like. And you got a new owner, and they're just like, well, that's not my guy. That's not my quarterback.
That's the crazy thing. The DC universe might have its issues, the Snyder universe, but it hasn't been unsuccessful. You know, even Birds of Prey made money. Most of the movies have made money. And that's the crazy thing, man. Aquaman was a huge hit. You know, Wonder Woman was a huge hit. So it's weird. So we'll see, man. And Ben Affleck came out and said he's really not interested in directing anything, which is strange that he would sit in a room with James Gunn, do an interview saying, oh, yeah, we'll work together. And a few weeks later, he's like, I'm not directing anything. You know, Gunn is known for being pretty difficult to work with, you know, and that's no secret or anything. So, you know, and if Affleck's not wanting to really work with him either, it just makes you wonder where this will all go. I obviously love the DC universe, love these characters, and I hope it's successful. You know, but you could argue that James Gunn's career has been based on a couple of successful Guardians of the Galaxy films, you know?
Yeah.
So we'll see, where this all leads as we move forward. Willow is canceled after the first season. But some interesting comments from the producer came out that it wasn't canceled for the reason that people think it is. Bad ratings or anything like that. It was canceled because they wanted the actors to be able to be free of their contracts while they wait to see when they'll get around to season two. And so he's making it sound like season two might still happen, but yet it's canceled. So it's kind of weird. I feel kind of guilty because I'd never watched it and I wanted to. Because I really did want to see Willow. It just kind of came out in the fall and was real busy with fall baseball on Christmas time and just didn't really have a chance to sit down and watch it. So we'll see. You know, people waited years for a sequel to Willow, and they finally got it, and then it just looks to be one and done.
So yeah, I saw the first episode.
Yeah. It's the first Lucasfilm project to be canceled by Disney Plus so far.
Wow.
And the last bit of news, man, this is cool, man. I'm excited for this. Del Toro, Guillermo del Toro, one of our favorite directors, is going to make a live-action Frankenstein movie for Netflix. And it was announced this week. It's full on into casting mode. Rumors of possible Oscar Isaac playing Dr. Frankenstein, which I think would be fucking great casting. Yeah. So man, I mean, you hear Del Toro in a monster movie, you can't help but be excited. I mean, this is like nerd city.
It's what he does.
Yeah, it's what he does, man. And super excited for this. And you know, it used to be a time a couple of years ago, you hear it's a Netflix movie and you weren't, I don't know, it's a Netflix movie. But now obviously Netflix is in their game, man. They're making quality stuff. A lot of the movies have been good. You know, it's not like they're theatrical quality movies now, not like they were a few years ago when they first got into the movie game. So, you know, I think it's cool, man. I'm excited about that. You know, people were wondering what his next project was going to be after Nightmare Alley. And well, here it is, man. You know, he's Del Toro. We've talked about this before. He went to Universal. He said, let me make these movies for y'all. I want to make Frankenstein or The Mummy or whatever, man. And Universal was like, no, we got this. We got Tom Cruise on our side. And we love us some Tom Cruise on the Rebel Radio podcast, but The Mummy was not good. And that it wasn't even Tom's fault. The movie fell apart in the editing room. I don't know. Did you ever watch it? It's an edited mess.
Well, I mean, thought it was weird that somehow he couldn't be killed.
Right. The whole thing was weird. And Tom has even talked about it. He says that wasn't the movie we shot, you know, that it fell apart in the editing process. And maybe there was a better cut out there. Who knows? But so, you know, when Universal turns you down, Del Toro's like, you know what? Most of these characters are public domain. We can make our own Frankenstein movie. You know, it's weird how those rights work. I was reading Universal owns certain kind of rights to the Universal monsters, but like, because a lot of those characters are public domain now, because they're over 100 years old, they can be made by other studios, but they have to like put something in front of it. Like it has to be like Guillermo del Toro's Frankenstein or Mary Shelley's Frankenstein. So it's weird. Or it would have to be Guillermo del Toro's Dracula, you know? And sometimes they can ask permission to use certain characters. Like when they made the Monster Squad in the 80s, they asked Universal permission to use the character, and Universal gave them permission. So it's weird how it works with the rights of them. So,
well, Mary Shelley she was the person who wrote Frankenstein.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
So, you know, but Guillermo del Toro making a Frankenstein movie is certainly cool news. We do have another bit of news, but it was some sad news, which we're going to talk about here in a minute as we get ready to talk about today's featured film. And with the Lance Reddick, who plays the concierge of the Continental in the John Wick films, passed away today at age 60 from apparently natural causes. That's all we know so far. It was unexpected and sad. He was out doing press for John Wick Chapter 4, which comes out in a couple of weeks. They were on a European press tour, I believe, is what I read, doing the press for this movie. And he was found unresponsive. So we lost the great Lance Reddick today. And this is a guy I was a little late coming to his career. I'd heard about him through The Wire and stuff, but I was more familiar with him through the John Wick films, and always seemed to be a good presence on screen. And people that met him and talked to him, he was at Compalooza last year, just said he's a really nice, humble guy. And so unexpected tragedy today with the passing of Lance Reddick. Justice John Wick 4 is fixing to hit theaters in a couple weeks. And just as today, man, we are here to discuss John Wick Chapter 2 this week. And next week we're doing Chapter 3 to get you all caught up in the series before it hits theaters in a couple weeks. So, Matt, I'm going to let you summarize this week because I haven't let you summarize in a while. And remember, Matt, that means summarize, not tell the entire movie.
Yeah. So fresh off the heels of John Wick, we just step on the gas pedal into this film, and he's flying into the uncle of the punk kid that he just killed. And we get this awesome kind of like monologue narration from him talking about the John Wick. And I just wish he would just narrate the entire film. It's pretty awesome. Wick comes in, Keanu Reeves. He's a badass. He's getting hit by cars. It doesn't matter. You can't stop him. His legs aren't breaking. somehow, I don't know, he borrowed Chuck Norris's legs for the movie or something. And then after he gets his car, fucks it up again. He comes back home. We find out there's more to the underworld of this hitman universe that he's a part of. He owes Mr. D'Antoni a blood oath. He refuses. Shit goes sideways. Man, he's back in the shit again. And he's got to kill one of the head table members so this guy can snake his way in, start making big-ass decisions. We learn about some cool currency. I guess these old coins, I don't know what they're worth, man. He pays like one coin for a bulletproof suit, and then Common turns around and buys two drinks.
Yeah.
I was like, didn't you use that for like the same coin for the damn room? So I don't know exactly how it works, but you know, that's the whole thing about action films in general. Things don't make sense, and they're kind of a play on themselves, but you know, you take it for what it is. Yeah.
A phantom world.
Yeah. A phantom world.
Yes.
And you know, this guy, he blew up his house to make a point. Well, after John Wick does what he's supposed to do, you know,
I mean, they battling the dog through in the first one, and he goes on a rampage. What do you think you're gonna do? You blow up your fucking house. He's gonna go
exactly.
Ballistic.
Oh yeah, and he knows this. He puts a bounty on his head. It doesn't matter. John Wick's gonna battle through a whole city full of assassins. Not one cop shows up, by the way. I don't know. Right.
I don't think police exist in the John Wick world. Yeah.
Yeah. Maybe they just know there's like a red light district for this stuff. You stay away. I don't know. You know, and then we get this massive cliffhanger at the end as John Wick, you know, kills the new head one of the head table members
in the hotel, which
in the hotel,
sacred ground.
Sacred ground. You can't. That's home base. You can't touch me. I'm on home base. You know, and you know, he just executes him right there because you fucked up his home, man. That leads, of course, into John Wick Chapter 3, which we'll get on next week. But this film is, man, it's probably one of the most action-packed of the films just because of how it starts. Feel like you're literally going in, guns blazing, pedal to the metal, lot of action.
Right.
And it's super fun starting out.
Well, this is my favorite of the three so far. And I've been hearing about things about 4 that say the last hour of 4 is some of the best action you'll ever see. But my thing is about 2 is you hit some points on this is the absolute, it's the world building in this phantom world. It's incredible. It takes the idea of John Wick 1 and opens up into this world where we get to see how things work in this assassin universe. And it's so cool. That's probably my favorite aspect of the film. And mixed in between that is we get some fantastic fights between Wick and Common and Wick and Ruby Rose. You know, and their characters and we get to see Wick kill someone with a fucking pencil, which is awesome. Some incredible cinematography throughout the film, incredibly choreographed scenes. And so when I watch part 2, I'm like, man, is 4 literally better action than this? Because I think part 2 is a fantastic action film.
Oh, yeah.
The scene where when they go to the lady council member that he goes to kill that the mark is on, when they're going through the underground club catacombs. Or whatever,
yeah,
in the catacombs, that shootout it's wonderful. It's John Woo-esque, you know. It's just really awesome. So it's hard to think, and we'll talk about 3 next week. But by the time you get to part 3 started feeling a little repetitive. And we'll talk about that next week, because part two, you have such this incredible string of action sequences throughout this film. It's just like, what more can you do? You know, and that's where three falters some is. And again, we'll talk about that next week, is it starts to be a bit repetitive at that point because you've done so much action in part two. But I think I want to go back to the world building in part two. I mean, you know, I'm sitting here thinking from the mind of a writer, how they sat there and just came up with these ideas that seem they're so simple, but so effective. Like he's, you know, they've got a bank vault to store his extra guns, and they've got this whole weapon thing and this in the continent on the whole system. And it's incredible. And I remember seeing part two in theaters and going like, this is genius. You know, it's like, it's almost like you don't want to be an assassin, but you're like, man, this world seems pretty cool to live in. You know, does that make sense? Like from a fantasy standpoint,
the whole thing where he's getting ready, for the mission, that he has to undertake to get free again. It's like from the tailor where he's like, you know, how many buttons? Two. Yeah. It's like, what about the lining? Tactical. And I'm like, God, this is so fucking cool, man. You know, whenever he goes in for a tasting and, you know, this guy, you get this, you know, like food chef British kind of guy, vibe for him. Yeah. But he's testing out firearms and knives. And it's funny how he's describing things like firearms and weapons, like you would wine, robust, you know, and then he's like, and dessert. Oh, dessert. Some of our finest cutlery. And he's got like fucking K-bars and Italian switchblades and stuff like that. So it's pretty darn cool. Just the whole aspect of it.
And as an audience member, you buy into it, hook, line, and sinker, because they suck you into this world that they've built. You're already sucked in part one because like he killed a bunch of people because of his dog. And then it sucks you in again because he's going to kill a bunch of people because they destroyed his house. And then you get this built world, you get to visit, man, dude, we get fucking, what's his name is in this,
Franco Nero.
Franco Nero, man. The great Franco Nero makes an appearance as a Continental in Paris, was it? I can't remember. But and it's like the legend is on screen. Franco Nero, man. And like I wanted him to get a gun, really. I was like, I want to see Franco Nero go kill some people in this movie, you know? And just how cool is that, man, that they paid respect to the legend that is Franco Nero by having him in this film. And Wick does take a beating throughout this movie. I mean, I'm like, when him and Common are rolling down the stairs fighting each other, I'm like thinking, how is either one of them getting up? Their back has to hurt, their shoulders. I mean, it looked painful just watching on screen, you know? Like, it looks like it hurt. And then we get introduced to Lawrence Fishburne's character in this film, the Bowery King.
Yes. You know,
as Wick's trying to find a way to get out of his trouble he's in by using the Bowery King. He's like, just give me a gun.
He's 7 million for 7 bullets, which he uses in 3 seconds whenever he finally gets back to D'Antoni.
Yeah. But then he picks up a bunch of other weapons and shoots a bunch of other people in the head.
Yes.
I think this movie's got to have the record for headshots. It's like everyone's just getting capped in the head left and right in this movie.
He's like, and if he's not shooting you in the head first, he's shooting you in both kneecaps, then the chest, then the head. And it's like, couldn't you have just gone straight to the head and saved your bullets? You know, right. No, we've got to fucking decimate every single one of your joints and then take you out.
That's right. That's the way to do it. The gung fu in this movie is, it starts out at the very beginning whenever he goes to get his car and, it doesn't stop, man. It's just a remarkable choreography in this film. It's like one of those sequels that, it's like watching Top Gun and Top Gun Maverick. You know, it's just a completely different film. It grows and builds the world. And it's like that. It's like Terminator and Terminator 2. It's like John Wick and John Wick 2. And John Wick 1 is still really good. Terminator 1 is still really good. Top Gun is still really good. But the sequels just take the world and make them bigger and better and blow them up. And that's how John Wick 2 is. It's just takes the world and enhances it to this level of just pure fantasy action film. And the shootout at the end with all in the mirror rooms, that's genius, man. Whoever set designed that and came up with that idea, it's fantastic because you put you in another, the set pieces in this film really work well. And they did in the first, throughout the John Wick films, they just, I think a lot of action films sometimes, well, let's just shoot up a street or shoot up a building. But the John Wick films, I think, do a good job of setting up the action sequences in different really great set pieces that enhance the action even more.
A lot of long shots.
Yeah.
And then you've got that, I believe that mirror, where they get up into the mirror room is just a one take. It's a one take action scene. And that's phenomenal. You've got someone directing that knows action scenes, his body double from the Matrix, stunt double from the Matrix.
So, yeah.
He's been in witness to some strong.
And that's the thing too. I think Chad Stahelski, you know, he had a co-director in the first one, his writing partner. And I think by him doing two and three and now four himself, I think he's able to, in no disrespect to working with his writing partner, because the first John Wick is really good. But I think whenever a director is able to do his own thing, I think it allowed him to do better action sequences in part two and three than we got in part one, you know, plus the budget was a lot higher too. You know, that always helps.
Yeah. Yeah. Thanks to all the, you know, late success of the first film. And, yeah, it's. I think it made double what the first film did.
Oh yeah, it definitely made some money.
Because the first film, a lot of people kind of like discarded as just another, you know, Keanu Reeves movie. I think we talked about this before. You know, he had done like Man of Tai Chi, he had done like 47 Ronin, and you know, movies that looked cool, and then just didn't pan out. And we thought this was another one of those films. Turns out, it's a pretty damn awesome story. And, you know, it's proven its worth through the last couple sequels. It's damn entertaining.
It's become one of the great modern action franchises already in just the few, you know, 2015, I think was the first one. So, you know, now in 7-8 years, you know, four films, and it's become, well, like I said, one of the great modern action, sagas, and they're really good. You know, you go back to talk about the dialogue, how it's written, like, in a way, people don't really talk like that, but in this world, they talk like that. And then the genius of making Ruby Rose's character deaf and using sign language to talk. We find out that John Wick knows some sign language too. And he says things like, you know, I'll be seeing you. And it's world building. The fact that Wick knows sign language and he fights his character knows sign language. And it just continues to build upon things. We know that little things like we know him and Common's character had a past. We don't know what it is, but we don't need to know what it is. We just know that they really don't like each other.
Yeah.
You know, and that's it. That's all you need to know.
That's all you need to know.
The great Ian McShane, of course, back as Winston. And, you know, he even helps Wick in his own ways along the way. And, Ian McShane, man, is one of those guys that, you know, he's been a great character actor over the years, but I sometimes feel like, he could have been Ian McShane feels like that type of actor that could have been bigger, you know, like than he was. He's really got a presence on screen. He feels like he could have been like a great Western actor or something like that. Of course he was in Deadwood.
You can see that. Yeah.
And, you know, and he's good in this as always. And of course we see Lance Reddick again in this one as a concierge and, you know, and just hearing that he passed today, you know, his presence is definitely felt in these films. He's small part in them, but an important part, you know, where Wick leaves his new dog with him and says, do you mind watching him? He's like, sure. You know, we can board him. And he's like, what's his name? Dog. It's like,
does he have a name? No.
And when Wick goes to pick him up, he's like, he was excellent customer or whatever it was, you know?
Yeah.
And so you can't undermine Lance Reddick's importance to these films too. Cause you can almost say as being the concierge, he gives a levelness to all the action in this movie.
And he sets the tone to the Continental. Mm-hmm. He's the first thing you see when you walk in. He sets the tone of how it is in that building. Yeah. And really gives that building, that living space, you know, a personality.
Yeah.
Through his portrayal of the concierge. And then of course, he has a greater role in part three, which
will next week's episode. Yeah, he has an even bigger role. And so his presence will be felt. And, you know, when we see part four in theaters here in a couple of weeks, I'm sure we'll think about him when we watch it and his presence in the fourth film and see where he goes. And, you know, they did announce this week that, you know, the original plans for part four was to be shoot four and five back to back. But then, of course, the pandemic happened and they didn't do that. So there is a script apparently for part five. But at the same time, from what I've read, is four kind of ends in a way that they could end the series on that note. And Sulisky and Reeves did kind of announce this week that, you know, Wick's going to be put on hold after part four, at least for a little bit. So we'll see. But, you know, part two is the movie we're talking about today. And, you know, this is definitely one of my favorite modern action films. I think part two is fantastic. It's good. Some great scenes in it. The world building is extraordinary. You know, one of the best world building films in recent memory of how they took it in action film that was pretty simple on the surface and gave this a greater world than this one. And we got to see Wick kill someone with a pencil. I mean, it's hard to top that.
Yeah, man. But
the big,
cool,
huge Asian assassin who just won't die. He shoots him in the shoulders and the head and everything. It's like,
yeah,
just some dark humor in this film too. You know, in that sense, and then the way the movie ends, I remember when I saw this in theaters and he's excommunicado and Winston gives him 1 hour and, you know, you see all these phones lighting up and it got a little silly to an extent with those last few minutes of the movie where everyone's looking at their phone. I'm like, it's like you said, it's just like this red light district where there's nothing but assassins in the city. It's a little ridiculous, but
even the bums are assassins.
Yes. But then when we get to part three, we kind of understand why as things kind of, you know, open up even more to that extent, but it was a little comic bookish at the end of part two. I remember thinking that, but it all works out in the end. But John Wick chapter two is definitely, we'll see how part four pans out, but right now it's my favorite in the series so far.
Oh yeah. And you know, that's Keanu. He kept most of his training, you know, kept it up from the first movie, and it didn't take him long to get back into shape. His judo, his Brazilian jiu-jitsu, he did 95% of the stunts, and apparently his shooting, and I've seen his shooting, they said that it was so good it could rival a lot of active duty soldiers that are out there. And he's just, you know, he takes the role seriously. And I think that's why the action is just so awesome, because Keanu can execute it so well.
And he's such a humble guy too. That's the great thing about him, man. He does these things to entertain people. And he was in Austin, Texas earlier this week for the premiere of part four. It premiered at South by Southwest. And, you know, they said that he just was talking to people, real humble to answer questions and hanging out, just being a guy. They said that that's how he is.
Just being a guy.
You know, he donates millions of dollars to charity and lives very modestly, you know, and he gives a lot back to people in need, because he's like, he said before, I don't need all this. What am I going to do with it all? You know? So he said he helped his parents and he helps a lot of people in need, and he just lives off of what he needs. And he makes movies to entertain people.
That's awesome, man.
Yeah, he just seems like a good dude. And I'm looking forward to seeing part four in a couple of weeks. But in the meantime, we're going to preview next week's film, as we're going to continue with John Wick next week and get you ready for part four hitting theaters, which will hit theaters next week by the time you hear the part three episode. But that's okay. You can still get caught up on all the John Wick action, as next week's movie is John Wick Chapter 3.
Jonathan, what have you done?
To dream the impossible dream.
There's no escape for you. The High Table wants your life.
To right the unrightable wrong.
Tell me what you want.
Passage.
I can't help you.
To reach the unreachable star.
Do you expect him to make it out?
A $14 million bounty on his head. Everyone in the city wants a piece of it. I say the odds are about even. Doc, 5 seconds.
John Wick, excommunicado, in effect, in 3, 2, 1.
And away we go.
The old days. Just a conversation.
Nothing's ever just a conversation with you, John.
Reach the unreachable
star. And another good one, you know, as we continue the story from part two and opens up the world even more, and more bad guys come to cause trouble for John Wick, and he's going to kill a whole lot more motherfuckers next week.
That's right.
And we get the great action star Mark Dacascos in a kind of different role for him in John Wick Chapter 3.
I think
that's the cool thing too, man. They brought in Dacascos, and Part 4's got Donnie Yen. It's like they brought in some cool ass motherfuckers for these John Wick.
Hell yeah, dude.
You know, and
I know him from Iron Chef.
Yeah. And there's a great, I think I talked about this before, there's a great French film called Brotherhood of the Wolf, and Mark Dacascos is in it. And it's inspired by true events about a monster living in the woods, and they have to hunt him and all this. And it's got some cool action sequences in it. And Monica Bellucci naked a few times in it. So it's worth watching if you've never seen
Brother. There we go.
And so it's a good movie. It shows up on Vudu pretty often for like $5, man. I actually have a DVD copy of it. I've been thinking about grabbing it one time, and it goes on Vudu for cheap because Brotherhood of the Wolf is a pretty cool film. But yeah, so next week we're going to talk John Wick Chapter 3. Oh man, wait, we had a sub feature, man.
That's right. Dude, don't forget, man.
This month in pop culture history.
That's right. I got a couple things for
us. Let's do it, man. I hope people didn't just tune out after the preview of next week's film like they do sometimes. Man, Matt, you should have interjected, man. Like, Mark, don't forget.
I know, man. You're pilot going along. I didn't realize
that. Yell at me, man. Yell at me.
So this month, pop culture history, 1933, King Kong premiered. Obviously, we got some beast movies coming out soon. And man, he's one of the biggest beasts out there.
All-time
so
classic.
King Kong, 1933.
We covered that movie a couple years ago in the show. And I actually thoroughly enjoyed watching that, man. It was a fun one to watch, that classic film. Without King Kong, man, you might not get most of the big monster movies we've had. I mean, definitely one of the biggest inspirations of all time.
Oh yeah. It definitely inspired the kaiju craze for sure. 1965, of course, we had the Oscars recently, and the Academy Awards are kin to that. 1965, one of the most popular musical films of all time, Sound of Music, starring Julie Andrews and Chris Plummer. Premieres Academy as an Academy Award winner for Best Picture in 1966. So Mary Poppins, I thought it was notable. You know, Frank
just
likes musicals, so you know.
I don't have a problem with musicals. Yeah. I just don't like the sound of music. it's boring, to be honest.
It's boring.
We didn't even talk that in the news, man. I slacked in the news this week. Man, the Oscars, I just want to say Everything Everywhere All at Once, we were right. They won Best Picture. Ke-Han Quinn, Best Supporting Actor. Michelle Yeoh, Best Actress. Thank you. Fantastic.
They won everything.
It deserved everything. It deserved everything it's got. It was really neat seeing Ke-Huy Quan say, there's a lot of famous people here. That's just how humble this guy is. You know, he's like, he doesn't realize he's famous too. But yeah, that's just, it's so cool. And just seeing him reunite with Harrison and Harrison hand out Best Picture and seeing those guys hug each other like they did with Indy and Short Round and Temple of Doom. It was really great, man. I'm not a, in my modern times, one of my, I mean, I don't watch the Oscars every year. I did watch them this year. I kind of followed them on Twitter, but that was a great Oscar moment, you know, to see them hug each other. It's awesome. I'm glad, so glad that movie won a bunch of awards.
Very cool, man. And he's just when you see someone come from where he came from, being a refugee, coming here on a boat, and now he's on one of the biggest stages we've got, you know, and winning. That's the American dream right there.
Yeah, incredible.
Just story. Like he said, yeah.
And like, you know, sometimes with celebrities, you like, oh man, man, they make lots of money. I don't feel, you know, I don't feel bad for him. Like with him, you do feel good for him because he's humbled. He's not lying. He's telling the true story.
Yeah.
And he worked hard and he earned it, man. It wasn't handed to him. And so it is an amazing story and deservedly so, you know, absolutely.
Absolutely.
So happy,
man,
for him. Now, Disney Plus, make a Short Round television show happen. God damn it. Let's
Boom.
Get it.
Let's and, do and, it. You and, heard and, it.
In indie lore, Short Round becomes archaeologist because of his hero. Let's make it happen. Even if it's just a mini series. Even if it's just a mini series. Let's do
At
it.
At least a spinoff.
Yeah.
We talked about a monster universe. Well, guess what? This month, TV hit movie history, 1922, the first vampire film, Nosferatu, an unauthorized adaptation of Bram Stoker's Dracula, premieres in the Berlin Zoological Garden in Germany.
Yeah, that's a very well-known early monster film. It's kind of a short film, isn't it? It's like 45 minutes long or something.
Yeah, it's not long.
Yeah, I think so, yeah. But, you know, even some of those Universal Monster movies are only an hour and 10 minutes, you know.
Yeah. Especially only now have we gotten to the three-hour movie.
Well, you know,
range.
A lot of the reason why the projector bulbs back then, they got so hot, they couldn't run longer than like 75 minutes. That's why a lot of those early movies are only like 75 minutes long. They couldn't run longer than that without switching the bulbs out.
Didn't think about that. Yeah. It's kind of like those fun facts, like certain tracks had to be a certain amount of length on records. So that's why all around the Watchtower, Jimi Hendrix, you had this really, really long guitar riff because there had to be one. Mm-hmm. If it some of these things not been in play, you wouldn't get certain things the way they are. That's pretty cool learning about that. Harrison, we just talked about Harrison. And this is an odd film TV history thing, but I remember it. 2015, Harrison crash landed his 1942 aeronautical ST-3KR airplane in California. And I remember us freaking out because we're like, no, man, Star Wars is coming back out again. Dude, we can't lose Harrison, man.
Yeah, then he breaks his foot on the Millennium Falcon set or something while filming Force Awakens. It's like, come on, man.
He'd been giving us some scares.
Well, I think he had already shot Force Awakens, but the movie wasn't out yet. And at that time, we didn't know they were going to kill Han Solo in the film. And we're like thinking, you're right. We're thinking, no, man, there's new Star Wars movies. You know, the episode 7 out. You got to,
yep.
Damn it, Harrison.
We talked about Scream 6 last week. And I talked about a horror comedy this week. And in 1981, this month, the first homicide at Disneyland, an 18-year-old was stabbed to death. I didn't know that. I want to learn more about it. I didn't do as much research.
You've never read any of the haunted stories about Disney?
Like, no.
There's a lot of stories about their believing Disneyland is haunted. Yeah.
Man.
There's been people that... reports of people that like the night security, hearing noises, hearing children's noises, things like that. There's been, look, you should Google it.
I'll have to Google it.
There's some stories, interesting stories about the hauntings of Disney. Yeah.
It's been 10 years since, his passing. And, in 2015, we got a release of, See You Again, for Fast and Furious 7, Paul Walker. Of course it was a tribute to him. Rip Paul Walker, man. 10 years ago, this month.
Hmm. Yep, it's hardly been that long.
Yeah,
yeah. I did. You know, I did rewatch. I watched The Dark Knight this week just for the heck of it, and you just made me think about that because Heath's passing anniversary wasn't that long ago either.
Yeah,
so, you know. I don't know. I just felt like watching Dark Knight the other day, so I watched it.
I'm always sad when you see people gone too soon. You know, oh, yeah. It sticks with you.
Yep, for sure. Cool. Good stuff, man. I'm sorry we threw it at the end of the show, man. You gotta yell at me, Matt. Like, Mark, don't. Yeah. Man, I studied for this, man. Don't fuck up my shit, man.
I got one more because I didn't want to leave on a sad note. So 1997, Selena was released, of course, based on Selena Quintanilla, very popular here in Houston, the Queen of Tejano. And of course, Jennifer Lopez played her. And it's just a reminder. I just want to remind people out there, Jennifer Lopez, she has a big caboose, right? She had to wear butt pads to play Selena. Okay, so Selena's caboose was even greater. So just making people aware, folks, that 1997, that's what happened.
If you got to end a show, end it with some ass.
That's right. Yeah.
You know, I mean, why not?
Why not?
I've never watched Selena. I'm aware of it. I've just never watched it.
Yeah.
But, you know, not my thing. But I appreciate, you know, I completely live in Houston, Texas, understand the community that she touched and that people, you know, appreciate her music and everything she did. So I completely appreciate all that. Just not my genre, you know. And
she was an Astros fan, damn it.
Yeah. But, so, you know.
Go Astros, too.
That's cool, man. Let's end it with some Selena ass.
And, there you go.
All right. Well, until next time, then this is officially the end of the show. And RebelRadioPodcast.com for all your Rebel Radio needs. Thank you, as always, for listening. Come back next week as we continue the John Wick saga, talking Chapter 3 next week as we get ready for Chapter 4 hitting theaters. And actually, depending on what – yeah, no, never mind. Not going to say it because we probably are going to record early. So we will not have seen 4 yet by the time we record. And so until next week. Thank you, as always, for listening. This has been Mark.
This has been Matt.
Remember, as always, just go there
and do it.